Evening all, those present, as well as those who might be tuning in via YouTube. Tonight, Brother David Herman is going to commence a three-part series on Joseph, the suffering of Joseph. So you should write things down rather than relying upon a note that was left at home. Now, we look forward to what Brother David does deliver for us over those three sessions. So Brother David doesn't have a particular reading that we're going to begin. However, he has indicated to me that obviously we'll be turning up a couple of sections of scripture, and we will be just reading from those as we go through the class. So Brother David, we look forward to your deliberations. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me along. It's a pleasure to be back here. I always enjoy coming here and wish I could come more often. But other things often keep me away from where I'd like to be. Now, whether we look up too much will depend very much on how efficiently I get through things, because sometimes I have been known to have too much material to get through the amount of time I have allocated. So just see how we go. I guess the reason for not having the reading is that we're actually going to be talking through the story. So, question for you all. Why should we look at the life of Joseph? Didn't hear that. He is absolutely inspirational. I actually was planning, originally when I was asked to come back and do another series of talks, I was going to talk about Jacob. Talking about Jacob can be a bit depressing, really. But I am inspired by Joseph, and I got reading about him, and I just thought, no, I'm going to swap to this. So there's also another perspective that's made me think about it more seriously. Who's the most important person in Genesis?
God.
Yeah, can't argue with that. Okay. Human. Pardon? Perhaps Abraham. And you can't question his importance. But the reason I ask my question is that there's actually more written about Joseph in Genesis than anybody else in Genesis. Now, I think that alone tells us there's something really important going on here. And it's important long term, but I'm not going to explain that at this stage. Let's get into things and see how we go. So, fortunately, I don't have to rely on the computer connection working. So I'm just going to use it to remind me of different things. I've used a few other sources, so when you come across a good point I might make, if I make any, that's probably from the other sources I've looked at. And the ordinary points that you already know, they're probably just me. But it's worthwhile being reminded of these things. So, where are we going to start? One thing I do want to say is that the story of Joseph is absolutely gripping. It's almost like a novel that was written specifically to get us engaged and keep us always on edge as to what's going to happen next. And that's just the way it goes, right through to the end with surprises all the way through. So I'm going to begin. For those who want to sort of follow me, I'm starting at chapter 37. And I think the story of Joseph starts with the comments in chapter 37, verse 2 to 4, and I'm going to read the particular version, which is a Hebrew scholar's translation. And Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons, for he was the child of his old age, and he made him an ornamented tunic. And his brothers saw it, and he saw that it was he their father loved more than all his brothers, and they hated him and could not say a kind word to him. And I believe the word kind there is the word shalom. They couldn't say anything that's shalom. They couldn't be peaceable to him at all. Jacob's family, and Jacob in particular, is shown to be deficient all the way through the story of Joseph. And I think that's one of the fascinating things about this. If you were in ancient times and you wanted to teach your children how to behave, the common way was to give them stories of the heroes and tell your kids to copy them. And we often think of the ancestors of Christ, the people in the line to the Messiah, as being heroes of faith, and they are. But their behaviour as recorded is pretty ordinary, because the real hero of the book of the whole Bible is God, and it's all really about what he's doing that's supposed to impress us, not the people that we tend to think of that are our forefathers and the ones we should be following. But that's another exhortation, so I'm going to stop at that point about that. So much of this story we're going to see shows Jacob's family as dysfunctional, and the main one responsible for that is Jacob, because his leadership is pretty ordinary as a father. And that's confirmed in what I just read for you. Israel loved Joseph more than all of his sons. Now, I'm a father, and my girls regularly would say to me, which one of us is the favourite? And I would say, I cannot choose. You are all loved equally. And my younger two would go away, and Tammy would stay back and say, now tell me. I know it's me, isn't it? But we refused. We tried very hard not to do that. But this didn't start with Jacob. This started with Abraham. Abraham had a favourite son. Who was?
Isaac.
Okay. And the other sons all got shifted out of the scene. And Isaac showed favouritism to his chosen son, which wasn't Jacob. It was Esau. And that was a massive problem for Jacob. But the lesson we learn from this is, even though we hate what our parents did in terms of bringing us up badly, we have copied without thinking about it. We have to be incredibly careful to try and avoid that as both the parent but as the child, not to just carry on and live out what we learnt. We need to recognise that we have a trap that we may fall into copying exactly what they have done and do no better. And so by what Jacob did, he actually created this terrible disharmony in his family. Now, it was partly because of the fact that it was Rachel's son, Joseph, and Rachel was, of course, his favourite wife, and that's another story. But in reality, it's Benjamin that was the true son of Jacob's old age, which he gave as the reason for loving Joseph more than the others. So what else was I going to say about that? How about you just turn up chapter 42, verse 38, and can I get someone to read that for us, please? Now, this is much later, but it just shows how significant his attitude was. Has anybody got that?
I'll read it.
Yep.
And he said, my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is left alone. If mischief befall him by the way in the which he go, then shall you bring down my grey hairs with sorrow to the grave.
Okay. What's he saying about Benjamin now that at that stage Joseph's gone? He's saying he's the only one left. I can't lose him. He actually talks as though none of the other sons are his sons, or even if they are, they just don't matter. It's pretty extreme stuff. And those brothers lived with that, and that is behind much of what has happened. Now, Joseph was given an ornamented tunic. We don't really know a lot about that. Apparently there's some evidence that Tamar had a similar tunic, and many people who are commentators consider that was a sign of being superior, in a high status, and it wasn't something that everybody would get. But also, it was the kind of robe that was not suitable for working in. And some commentators actually think it means that they are exempt from labour. So Joseph was in a superior position and honoured by his honoured above his older brothers. And as we probably all know, in Hebrew culture, your standing is based on your age. Your older brothers are always more important than the younger brothers, and the parents, of course, are more important than the children. And so for him as the youngest son, or at least initially, until Benjamin came on the scene, for him to be honoured in that kind of way is really setting the others up for anger. And unfortunately, the other brothers fully recognised this and they just hated him. So now things all got a little worse with dreams. Joseph had some dreams. And what I want to ask you now is, do you think those were dreams from God or from his own mind? And hopefully with a supporting explanation.
From God.
You think they're from God, okay.
They were effectively a prophecy that did come true.
And that's one of the strongest arguments you can come up with. But we'll see if we can find some counter-arguments. Anyone want to argue the opposite?
Well, if he'd been given the robe, he knew that he was more important than his brothers. So maybe that, I mean, he was still human and all those thoughts go through your mind. So, in one of the dreams, the mother bows down. So the dreams didn't completely come to their exact fulfillment.
Yeah, that one we can't really be sure of because it easily could have been Leah that was referred to there as the essential stepmother of Joseph. So not really sure. One counter-argument. Oh, someone else can jump
was
in.
Was it something to do with the meaning of the dreams being revealed?
Pardon? Through the...
meaning of the dreams being revealed? Was there anything in that?
Can you explain what you mean? Meaning
some of the miracles and that the meaning of them is described, same with Daniel, I think, some of the prophecies. So I didn't know if there was somewhere that the actual meaning of the dream was revealed, because he actually tells it, but is there a line there that says it was revealed to you?
He actually just tells the two dreams,
yep.
And the meaning is plain to everyone in this case. Unlike some of the others that are very common in the story of Joseph. But one thing that makes me stop and hesitate is that up until this point, every time a dream is mentioned in Genesis, it actually says it's from God in some clear way, like Genesis 20 verse 3, God came to Abimelech in a dream by night. Jacob's dream, God stands above him and says, I'm the Lord, your God of Abraham, your father, and so on. And time and time again, I believe in every single instance before Joseph's dreams, it's always made clear that they have come directly from God. So I stick with Stephen's decision because they came true. Later on, Joseph actually says that when it comes to dreams, when you get a second dream that's parallel or on the same lines, it's making very clear that that is absolutely going to come into effect. And you'll find there's lots of pairs in all of the story of Joseph. Let me see if I can... So you have the butler and the baker had dreams. You had Joseph having two dreams. You had Pharaoh having two dreams. And on it goes with a second one, which does tend to emphasise its truth, according to Joseph. Okay. Now, Joseph is an interesting character. I've had some discussions with a friend of mine who disagrees with me on this, and you are at liberty to do so. But I think one of the problems that arose from the approach of Jacob to favour Joseph was that Joseph was somewhat arrogant. Does anyone want to violently react against that?
He was a type of Christ.
He was a type of Christ. He's almost the up about second in terms of the examples we get in terms of just how outstanding he is. So that's a very relevant point.
I think the fact that he just tells his brothers the dreams, we can't attach to that an emotion or a tone of voice, but why tell them at all?
Mm.
It's almost like a put down. And when in Egypt, much later, the brothers were terrified that he was going to really pay them out, why did they think that of him? Had he somehow conveyed that vengeful spirit? I'm not saying he did, but they were really terrified that they were going to cop it. Maybe there was something in his personality that betrayed that, I don't know.
Just like to make the point, David, there, that in Genesis 42, verse 9, he uses the term about them, he uses the term lahem, which can well mean for. I had dreams for you. And interestingly enough, perhaps Joseph now better understood that his youthful dreams were about doing something for lahem, his brother, saving them, showing them grace, not simply meaning that he would have power over them. And that's a Bible theme, isn't it? When you think about it, you know, he didn't really want them bowing down, begging them for gratitude for his grace and salvation, but he was trying to show them that there was something better, and he wanted them to repent. That also was a Bible theme.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's picked up in that term, you know, that it uses. Joseph remembered the dreams which he dreamed about them, and he said to them, you are spies. Now, that idea of spies comes up basically saying that he wanted them to bring them to repentance. The word spy or repentance is in that thinking in the Hebrew. Just a point.
Okay.
So I think that the dreams had a purpose.
Yep. Was he just nice, naive, good, coming true, pure, all those things, and he ran out to tell them lovely stories, and he thought they would all love it, as a good person, but they didn't. And is it Christ versus human nature and our sibling rivalry, and sometimes they are just good people, and he's can't stand them.
I think it's actually both. I think he had a certain level of arrogance, but a significant sense of naivety and unawareness of how he was impacting on other people.
I think he thought they would share the joy.
Mm. I also think he was highly intelligent, obviously, because wherever he went, he found favour. He rose to second in Egypt and was given control over everything. And obviously, from a young age, that was same. That's why maybe he wasn't a worker and had to vote, because he was thinking, he was knowledgeable, maybe that came across as arrogance, because he knew so much more than the other brothers, even though he was younger.
Yeah, like, we know, obviously, even though there's no specific fault recorded in him, we know that he wasn't, you know, perfect in his character, because only Christ knows that.
Yep.
But it is interesting that in chapter 37, he does seem quite earnest in when his father sends him out to look for his brethren. Like, you know, if he was a bit more arrogant and, like, he doesn't find them where they're supposed to be, he could just be like, oh, well, they're not here, I'll go back and tell Dad that, you know, they've chooked off somewhere. But he looks around, he seems quite earnest, asking around, trying to find them. He seems like he's taking that job and that role seriously, and it doesn't seem like he's doing, like, I can't read those verses, like verses 12 and 12 to 17, really without, in that negative light of Joseph. Like, he seems very good to his brothers in that section at least.
Except that the first recorded thing about his interaction with his brothers is that he actually told about what they did wrong. I better get back to that. I skipped over that.
He is only 17.
Yeah. And my point is that he isn't aware that he's arrogant. It is possible to be quite arrogant and have no idea of it. And just because it's a deficiency that hasn't been fixed doesn't make you a bad person. And we need to understand that. We can encounter people who come across very harshly or arrogantly or whatever, and they may be absolutely unaware of it. And so don't think for a minute that I'm criticising or lowering the opinion you should have of Joseph. I think extremely highly of him. And as you said, he's very capable and he wants to do the right thing by everyone. The words that are actually involved frequently when he starts to talk about his dreams is he says, and look, and look. He is almost surprised. He wants them to share in the surprise of what God seems to be saying. It's not like he thinks he deserves it. He's surprised, but he's insensitive to how they're going to feel about it as much older brothers and what it says to them. And particularly when he's going to give a second dream, that seems to go even further. And so even Jacob reacts and says, do you mean to reign over us? Do you mean to rule over us? Sorry, that's what his brother said. But when he dreamed the dream and the sun, moon and stars and 11 stars were bowing down to him, his father was, taken aback and said, shall we really come, I and your mother and your brothers, to bow before you to the ground? That was a shocking thing to say to your parents in those times. So I think we have to see a young man who isn't particularly self-aware, has a significant deficiency or deficiencies, but enormous potential. And he is unfortunately going to be forced to grow up very quickly. I'm going to skip along so that we finish before 9:30. Sorry, yeah, by 8:30.
David, when you're getting comments from the audience, could you just summarise that for those online?
Oh, sorry, yes. Thanks for the reminder, Sebastian.
We'll move on now.
Yeah, let's move on now. I'm sorry for those at home if you didn't hear any of that. Maybe we need a sort of microphone in the middle of the room that picks up all of those. Okay. So Jacob gave a mild rebuke to Joseph but did nothing more, as he often responded. He was very commonly giving no real response to things that are quite serious. But his brothers were jealous of him, and jealousy is a dangerous emotion, as the Bible makes very clear to us. It's based on a belief that we deserve what someone else has, and that leads to serious wrongs, usually, if we do not control it. And it's not long before the story actually shows the outcome of that, because it almost led to Joseph's death. I actually believe that the brothers did deserve much better from their father. He should have valued them all. But jealousy is a fruit of the flesh. It's the opposite of love. It's a catalyst for conflict, as said in Galatians 5, 1 Corinthians 13 and James 3, etc. In fact, in Romans 1:29, it says jealousy is a mark of unbelievers. And as a father, he should have been aware of that feeling amongst his sons and the trouble that it was causing and done something about it before it was too late. Okay, let's skip along a bit. I guess we can go straight to what's what you know is coming, because you all know the story. So what happens next? Well, the next thing, the brothers are off taking the flocks into better pasture, which happens to be in one risky place to go. Where, anybody remember what it was? They went somewhere else first. Shechem. Why was Shechem a place you wouldn't have expected them to go back to too readily? What happened at Shechem? Just about wiped out, well, wiped out all of the men and took all of the rest of the people of that city away with them as servants, basically. And I believe that there's an indication that trouble is brewing. This is telling us that things are warming up. Anyway, they moved on to Dothan. And so Joseph, when he was sent by his father to find them and see how they were going, went on further. And someone said that they'd moved on, so he went to Dothan to find them. And they immediately recognised him. The brothers saw the tunic, and their immediate response was conspiring to kill him. They said, "Here comes the dream master." In terms of the Hebrew, that's what it means, or an expert in dreams. And the word used in Hebrew apparently is quite sarcastic. Their first idea was to kill him and then throw him into one of the cisterns. This was more brutal than we realise, because if they killed him and threw him into the cistern, that's where his body would have been left. And it was a cruel thing to refuse to let someone get a proper burial. The Hebrews found that as an atrocity. So that was a particularly nasty suggestion. And in fact, if the dreams had been from God, then no plan of man was ever going to stop that happening anyway. So, surprisingly, who comes to the rescue? Yes, Reuben first. Why is that surprising? Because he has already been disfavoured, disinherited from the top role because of his inappropriate behaviour, which we won't go into. But Reuben comes to the rescue and wants to stop that happening. He tried to suggest that they shouldn't kill him. They don't want to be guilty of his blood. And so they hold off on that, but they still put him into a cistern. The cistern is essentially just a big water container, often had mud in the bottom, and it was impossible to get out unless you had someone with some rope to get you out.
Do you think part of Reuben's plan was to regain that lost favour from his father?
Actually, good point, just for those at home. Perhaps Reuben was trying to regain his lost image with his family. I think there's a genuine level of care here that he really was wanting to prevent this terrible thing that would be a permanent blot on the family.
Do we liken him to Pilate, who tried unsuccessfully to save the Lord? With a reference here to John 19:12, where it points out, according to his efforts, the unscriptural Pilate to save the Lord, and he's talking about Reuben. He's trying to make amends almost.
But it didn't work for Pilate.
No, it didn't work for the Lord.
So, possibly so. Okay. And as they're... the other thing that's particularly noticeable in this story is the minute they've thrown him into the cistern, they sit down to have a meal and drink. They feel perfectly at ease with what they've done. Basically, it seems that they are just going to let him rot and die there. Slow, long, unpleasant death. And the only reason it changed was along came some Ishmaelites, also known as Midianites, and we're not too sure whether they were genuinely Ishmaelites, but if they were, they were probably close relatives because it wasn't that long, and in fact Ishmael was probably still alive. Excuse me a second, need some water.
Just a comment then. In 42 verse 21, after finding out who this man in Egypt was, Joseph, the brothers say, "We saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear."
Yes.
So that's not mentioned there in chapter 37.
No.
But he was obviously screaming out from the bottom of his pit.
Yes.
"Get me out of here."
Yep. For those at home, Stephen's pointed out that later on in the story we are told that he was screaming out in anguish and they refused to listen to him. They did not care. They showed no empathy whatsoever. In fact, Judah's suggestion that they don't kill him seems completely motivated by the profit that they would gain from it. He says, "What gain is there if we kill our brother and cover up his blood?" So this doesn't seem like a suggestion to save his life. It actually seems like a way to make some money out of a difficult, annoying situation. So they sell him off to the Ishmaelites, and we need to think about just how Joseph is feeling at that stage. So Joseph now is put in the hands of people who are going to take him down to Egypt. He's then going to be sold as a slave, all the while knowing that his brothers hated him so much they would do anything to get rid of him, which is a horrible thing to think about your family. He would never see his father again, he's probably suspected. He's going to go and live in a new country and have to learn a new language. He's going to be a slave doing whatever he was expected to do as a slave. He is in an utterly hopeless situation, it would seem, from a human perspective. And not only were they inflicting pain on Joseph without caring, they should have known they were going to be inflicting great pain on their father. They knew he was the favourite son, and they did not care for their father either enough to say, "We shouldn't do this. What's it going to do to our old father?" And he was fairly old even at that stage. Now, they covered it up. They covered it up with killing a goat. And I believe that the writer to Genesis is very clever in giving us allusions to the past. Anybody think what he might have been alluding to from Jacob's past? Oh, very good, Tanya. So, yes, Jacob slaughtered a kid and used it to be part of the deception to pretend to be Esau. And there's another hint there too. When the disguised Jacob deceived his father, the words were, "He did not recognize him." And when they take the ornamented robe of Joseph back to its father, they asked him if he recognized his son's robe. And there seems to be this dual little emphasis there of linking back. And one thing I'm convinced that that the writer is doing is to show us that when you're a deceiver, you end up being deceived. And that's certainly true in the life of Jacob and Laban earlier in the story. So some of what he has sown is coming back is having to reap. So the brothers go back and show the robe, and unfortunately Jacob accepts their deception, is convinced that Joseph's been killed by a wild animal, and expects never to see him again. With extreme mourning, he rent his clothes, he put on sackcloth, mourned for Joseph for a long time, and refused to be consoled by his sons and daughters. And so the language is emphasising the extravagant mourning, and apparently he was saying that he would just go down to his death mourning Jacob's death. And he shed a lot of tears. But even when the story continues, and I'm just moving on quickly, the next word is but. And then we start in a different direction in Egypt. And the but, I think, is telling us that that's not the end of the story and a bit of a contrast of what's going to come. And I'll talk very quickly about that and then get some overall lessons we can learn from this. So Joseph's taken down to Egypt. He's sold to Potiphar, who's a court official. We're not totally sure exactly what that meant. He was obviously a fairly important person. He was involved in killing. The word associated with it is a root word that involves the word slaughter. So maybe he was an executioner or he was just head of the guard. But apparently the word for his position can also be translated eunuch, which I think is relevant to the story of what happens. And the chapter finishes in a way that indicates that's the end of that part of the story. But, and I'm not going to spend much time on this because I just want to draw more into the suffering aspect. We know from moving on to chapter 39 that in fact after spending some time, Potiphar promotes him to the highest position in his home and has recognized his many qualities, and Joseph seems a wonderful servant. But unfortunately Potiphar's wife wants to do the wrong thing with him, and because Joseph refuses that, he is accused of rape, and the wife of Potiphar tells her husband, and he gets thrown in prison. To be honest, I don't think Potiphar actually fully believed it. If he was an executioner and he really believed his wife, I think he would have put him to death. Not just simply put him in prison. So I think he's got suspicions about his wife. But there he stayed for a long time. And even after he interpreted accurately the dream of the butler and the baker, unfortunately the butler forgot him for 2 years. And the actual Hebrew there is two years full of days is how the Hebrew goes, which I think is particularly emphasising that they were long, hard, lonely days in prison, perhaps with no sunlight at all. So he suffered an enormous amount. He's suffered at the hands of his family, hating him so much that he is considered best killed. Fortunately not saved and rescued ultimately by God, and he is taken and then forced to live a totally different life away from his family, unfamiliar circumstances, and even then mistreated again while absolutely innocent. So I want to jump across to some lessons we can learn from this. My first lesson, and because I've made this all about Joseph's suffering, first lesson I think we need to learn about suffering is that suffering is inevitable. Would you all agree with that? Why is it inevitable? Because that's the way God made it from our first sin on this planet. But suffering was done for a reason. In fact, we should look this one up. Romans chapter 8. Because it tells us why this all happened. That's in verse 20, Romans chapter 8, verse 20. The creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself would be freed from its bondage to decay and will obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. I think that verse is telling us that the only hope for us was to suffer. That everything in life will involve, sorry, that's exaggerating maybe, but an awful lot of things in life will involve suffering. Everything will break down, let us down. People will let us down. What we buy won't last. It'll break down. Nothing lasts. Everything is just seemingly futile. And that's to show us that we weren't meant to live like this. That God always plans something much better for us. But this is the consequence of when we disobey God. And the sooner we recognise it through the suffering that we experience, the more we turn to God. This is the only way that we will recognise we need to put our trust in God, when we realise that everyone and everything in this life will let us down. It's a horrible thing to think of, but it's our only hope. So why is suffering inevitable? Because of us. We are here. We're imperfect. We sometimes play favourites. We don't treat people as they should. We don't give way. We insist on our own way. We think we have a right to things and we fight for it at the expense of others. The world is telling us that everybody can do and say and be exactly what they want. But the reality is, if I get what I want, you can't have what you want. And that's inevitably going to cause clashes. So that way is the wrong way. But suffering is inevitable because of that. We're all competing for what we want if we are acting in natural ways. A couple of quick questions, with hopefully some good answers. In what way does Joseph give us an example of suffering? And I know I haven't covered all of the details of all of the story, but hopefully you're familiar enough with it. In what ways does Joseph give us an example of suffering? Or how to suffering best? Suffer best, sorry. Mm-hmm. Can you be specific about what attitude?
So throughout it all, he continued to obviously have a spirit that was, because the Lord prospered him in the prison, so he was still keeping that spirit of goodness, really.
Absolutely.
Even amongst really trying circumstances.
Okay. Where do we see the evidence of this goodness? You've hinted at it, Tanya, there. I'm hoping someone's going to pick up on that.
Verse 23 of chapter 39. Because the Lord was with him, and that which he did, the Lord made prosper.
Okay. I'm going to come back to that point a bit later, if I can.
He never blamed God for his suffering.
Yeah. That's where we need to start looking at. How would we respond in that situation? We would be blaming. We'd be angry. We'd be furious. We'd bottle up all that anger until it just blasted out.
We want revenge on our siblings too when they came.
We would.
You know, when they came to get rescued, you'd be like, right, really?
Yeah. He never sought to give anyone a hard time. There is not a single complaint in all of the story of Joseph. No grumbling, being forgotten by the butler for 2 years, no recrimination. Even once he got to power, he could have absolutely done an awful lot of stuff to all of those people who let him down. Not one slight hint of any recrimination.
In 45 verse 5, he says, God sent me before you to preserve life. Now that meant going into the pit and going into prison. God sent me.
Okay. He maintains his absolute faith in God all the way through. The normal human response when God isn't giving us what we like, we say, I can't believe in you. This isn't right. And I know that there are people here who have suffered a great deal and could easily think, God has not treated me fairly. But that's not the way of faith. And Joseph is an example of holding firm to his faith with the most horrible of circumstances, not once, but twice. And he never, ever gave up hope. He seems always to have held on to the hope. And he comes through eventually absolutely convinced that this was simply God's plan, that he needed a way to achieve something. And I might even tell you what I think it's all about in a minute. Okay, so he held fast to his principles no matter what his suffering. There's no record of despair. You know, despair is a common thing in our day. People don't like what they're experiencing, so they take an easy way out and give up on life. But he never despaired. He was never angry with God. He kept close to God. And I believe that we actually never really know how much we need God until he is all that we have. This is something that made a massive impact on his life. He was changed by his experience, really changed. And so he was not just a God believer in the beginning. He was strengthened in his faith because God was always with him and he knew that God didn't give up on him. And when he was in the dungeon, that was all he had to hold on to.
He was really aware of God not departing from him. Like when he was in the pit, he could have gone, like, no, that's it, God's left me. But by the time he was in Potiphar's house, he was aware that God was with him because he says, how can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?
Absolutely.
He knew God was present.
Yeah.
He's very good at accepting God's will. I read it quite once, true happiness is accepting the will of God.
Yep.
It really is. Once you sign yourself over, surrender, all these words.
Exactly.
And he, I think that he was on his own, you know, he was on his own very lonely as a child, I would say. That wasn't fun. Yeah. He could have swung with the crowd.
Yeah.
Do you think also it was a dual effect in the sense that he realised that he was part of God's purpose, but he also could see very clearly that God was working his character as well through those trials?
It's very hard from the story to pick that up specifically, but in the long term, yes. It's clear at the end that he saw it all being an outworking of God's plan. But I would imagine that came from the day after day after day, thinking it through, praying about it, pleading with God for explanations. You know, I don't think that would have come quickly.
David, I love the way you made it come real and respect that day after day, but day after day in darkness.
Yep.
And we have this gentleman called Potiphar, and the word Potiphar and the word Pharaoh both mean the same thing, which means the sun. So you go back to his dream, and in this darkness, he's the slaughterer or the executioner of Potiphar comes, but his name means the sun. And in his dream, he looks forward to the time when ultimately these people would bow down to him. And that's part of what his prophetic dream was, and he was being tested for that. So I like that idea of darkness, but also the sun.
Well, I think the most important thing for us to learn is that he held on to faith. He was absolutely convinced that God was still there with him. And that's one of the most important lessons in life. We need to know that even if we have nothing else, we have God and he is enough. Because we may face that in the future. God is enough. If there's anything else that we say we must have that for us to be happy and at peace, then we're idolaters. Only God can supply all that we need. Only he is enough.
You
Stephen.
Can't know that you've got faith if it's not tested.
That's true.
We would much rather not have the test, but then you never know whether you have faith like Joseph.
True. I'm going to use my last 5 minutes to squeeze in a few things. I was going to ask you about lots of other these things, but I might just tell you what I think the answers to some of them are. But anyway, my first thing, I can't prove this, by the way, but this is my theory. If you read Genesis 38, and I don't suggest you do that now, but you're going to find the story of Judah and his family, and I think this is there right in the middle of the story of Joseph to tell us what's really going on. And basically it's all about Judah disappearing from the normal area that his family's in and going off and having just picking up a prostitute, having a family with her, having two sons that were so bad, each one of them God destroyed. And he ultimately was to be the leader of the family. But anyway, that's probably for next time. And he also refused to look after the second son's wife, Tamar, and is shown to be embarrassingly thoughtless and behaves terribly. And I think that chapter is just an example of what is going on by the increasing influence of the Canaanites that were there at that stage. And like I say, I can't prove this, but I actually think God is planning to maintain the line through to Jesus, the Messiah. And I think he wanted to get them away from that area and on their own where they would be free from that influence. And so I actually believe that God was preparing Joseph to actually be in charge, to because, of course, you know that the famine is coming, right? But the famine, I think, was a reason to bring Jacob's family down into Egypt and put them in an area where they could live separate from all the Egyptians and all the Canaanites and grow up under God's control, God's reign. He was wanting to preserve them from the negative influence that Jacob had created by his lack of proper parenting and threatened to have no longer a holy seed to continue the line. Now, you can talk to me later about whether you think that's just all in my mind, but I have a friend who's no longer with us but also believes the same idea, so it's not just me that thinks that. Anyway, my last few points. What can we learn from suffering? First thing I want to say, and I'm going to have to be brief, good people suffer. Don't ever think it's just because you're doing something wrong. Suffering comes into people's lives, even if they're doing all the right things, and that Joseph is a clear example of that. We are not in control of our lives. Suffering teaches us that we can't control things in our lives. And we need to know that, because if we don't, we won't learn to depend on God. We can learn the value of obedience. Jesus learned obedience by the things that he suffered. And he was a perfect man. Another thing we learn from the life of Joseph is that we don't always know why we are suffering, particularly while we are going through that suffering. Sometimes we never know. We learn from suffering that only God can be completely trusted. We learn from suffering that our hope and joy must not depend on circumstances or people, but on God alone. We learn from suffering that we don't have to get our own way to be at peace. Suffering develops character. And I don't know whether, Tanya, whether you picked the song to begin the night was, which was?
Purify My Heart.
I was so grateful that you picked that. Yeah. Right? M.
Can't
okay.
We all
I'm surprised. I'm surprised that Kent picked that. No, sorry.
Thanks,
Tom. Just joking, Kent. You know I think well of you. So God is always purifying us if we allow him to work in our lives. And so we will benefit from that, and God will refine us, and the refiner's fire makes us into what?
Pure gold.
Pure gold. That's what he was preparing in Joseph, pure gold. We always value what is going to remain perfect and pure, and that's what Joseph was becoming by God's work. He actually accomplishes great things. So suffering develops character. Long-term suffering develops patience, endurance, and resilience. One of the big problems with young people in our society today, not you guys here, but is there's almost no resilience. And I'm a teacher who deals with kids all the time, and absolutely evident all the time. One thing that we need to learn is that God values our character more than our comfort. It's a hard lesson to learn, but it's true. And God always uses suffering for good. But it may not be for our good. Joseph's life, I believe, Joseph's suffering was primarily for the good of God's purpose and his family. So we may suffer a great deal, but it actually be for the benefit of others. We need to know that God always brings good. Romans chapter 28, if you're still in it, which I am. Romans 8, 28. We know that all things work together for the good of those who love God, who are called according to his purpose. No matter how bad it seems, God will use it for good. I'm going to repeat what I said before. We never really know how much we need God until he is all that we have. And sometimes we have to get to that point to know that. So where is God in all the suffering? Two words. You can all shout it out. Where was God in all of Joseph's suffering? I was going to use right there is fine. What are the biblical words? He was with him. He never left him. He was always right there with him. And he will be for you too. Thank you.